les réformes dans l'Empire ottoman. Donc c'est Eda Gouklou qui nous vient de Central European University à Budapest. Donc il va intervenir en anglais. Et voilà. Donc c'est les réformes urbaines dans voilà.
Okay, it seems to working. Thank you very much, Fatia and Randi, for organizing this and inviting me. Okay. The Ottoman capital woke up to smoke-filled skies on the 7th of September 1865, after one of the biggest fires of the century engulfed the city during the night. It was a day of dispossession and calamity, and many found themselves hopeless against the merciless force of the catastrophe. Centuries-old tales of blazing wooden homes perishing in Istanbul probably did not help them to understand the destruction sparked in the Hocabaşı district of the city. In less than 20 hours, about 1,200 families were left in complete destitution. The fire only doubled their misery because an epidemic of cholera had already been raging through the city for some time. It was a calamity as destructive to property as the epidemic has been to lives. An enormous section of the Istanbul Peninsula was devastated. Approximately 3,000 buildings in 27 neighborhoods burned to ashes. Okay. And this is the main area of this fire. Even though this fire was devastating for imperial capital, an Istanbul-based English newspaper, the Levant Herald, considered it as a splendid opportunity for urban reform because it gave the government as a pretext to reimagine and reshape a more modern capital city. According to the newspaper, there was a lot to gain even though some people had to suffer. The fire was indeed seen as an opportunity by the government to create a regular urban space on a grid system and change the wooden fabric of the city to masonry. What mattered most for the government was the regularization of the street pattern in the city, as broad and regular streets came to be a measure of civilization in this period. In a similar fashion, Osman Nuri Ergin, who has been considered the first urban historian of the Republican period, argued that the Hocapaşa fire brought about happiness for Istanbul rather than disaster. To him, the planning activities carried out after the fire were largely a success story. According to him, many neighborhoods in the burnt-down area became the most prosperous and distinguished neighborhoods of Istanbul. Contrary to the views of the English newspaper and Ergin, a property-owning Muslim woman by the name of Habibe thought that what the urban planning process brought for her was not really happiness but injustice. And this was unacceptable in the age of justice and equity that she was supposed to be living. In her case, urban Tanzimat applied selectively because her grocery shop was pinpointed to be demolished among the others along the shore of the Golden Horn. She had a particular person in mind to accuse for the situation. It was the owner of a next door shop. But she was very unlucky because her neighbor was Mahmud Nedim Pasha, none other than the future Grand Vizier of the Empire. According to the claims of Habibe Hanım, Mahmud Nedim Pasha tried to seize her shop. Against him, she was all alone, having no male representative who could help her. Nevertheless, it was the age of justice and equity, she wrote in her petitions, that would help her neutralize this selective injustice. Another property owner, again a Muslim woman, namely Gülzar Hanım, had to defend her property against the urban officials who carried out urban reforms on the ground. Gülzar Hanım was a widow over 80 years old and in poor health. She fashioned herself in her petitions as in tears, with her honor broken because of the injustice that she went through after the fire. Like many other property owners, Gulzar Hanım was unhappy with the gap between the pre and post-fire value of her plot. The valuable location of her property in Marjan simply became valueless when her plot was replaced after the fire. And according to her, this happened through ways that involved bribery. As she presents the situation, she had to fight against corruption and the insults of the state officials, which were against the honor of humanity. But according to her, claiming one's rights was no offense. In 1866, 120 people from different neighborhoods presented a petition collectively to the city authorities in order to express their objections to the expropriation practices as a part of the planning activities. They were not very happy with what was going on in their daily environment because they had to sacrifice some portion of their properties for streets to be widened, in other words, for the general good. For them, the wider the streets, the narrower the parcels they were given. Some parcels became too small after expropriation that it was impossible to maintain their pre-fire usage. For instance, another woman by the name of Sherife Ganibe Hanım wrote in her petition that her property became too small a size that even a bed could not fit into. Apparently, all these people had different understandings of urban reform. What I mainly try to do in my research is to relate all these and other competing positions to each other in the context of capitalist modernity and property relations. I mentioned these particular cases because they represent certain punchlines of the issues that I will discuss today. First of all, let me talk about the position of the government. After the fire, the government initiated both a planning and a relief program. However, urban reforms were not easy to implement because all the location and relations in the area were to change considerably. The government needed to fashion a fiction of urban rent in order to moderate competing visions of urban Tanzimat and convince people of the benefits that redevelopment plans would bring about. It was a decisive process for property owners where the location and value of each property was to change in relation to another. Such a fiction was crucial to justify expropriation and the relocation of many parcels for the regularization of streets. In other words, the government had to offer a vision of a better future where city dwellers could position their interests as property owners. The government conceptualized expropriation as a sacrifice on behalf of property owners that they had to make in return for betterment values and the general good. Betterment values were expressed by the term şeref, that literally means honor. According to the government, everybody was to benefit from urban reforms through the increasing sheriff of their property. The relief program that was established immediately after the fire was also an important part of the fiction of urban rent as a mechanism to convince people of the harm that the existing material culture of the city imposed on the general good. However, the adjustment of betterment values to the sacrifices was itself a contingent and contested process, as there were competing definitions of general good or public good. What was good for the more effective circulations of goods and people through the creation of regular streets on a grid system was a matter of social as well as economic scaling that usually disregarded the tensions between the notions of justice, morality, and capitalist modernity. The construction of white streets was not only a matter of new urban aesthetics, but also a process of value creation in the built environment. Giving a new order to the city was also an attempt to change the relational values of property. Property owners were not hesitant at all to object to the rearrangement of their parcels within a block in varying values. Here we can see the scale of change in the physical space. And this is one example of this crooked and labyrinthine street pattern in the city before before the 19th century. And this is one of the most, you know, important cities of the Istanbul Peninsula, which is regularized after the fire. And this is around the turn of the century. Okay, the objections of people show that general interest was an abstract form of domination that city dwellers had to conform to in relation to a prospect of a better future. Their private interests were not always compatible with the fiction of urban rent that the government promoted as the material expression of general interest. The conflicts between private and general interest were contained in the fact that sacrifices were made privately, whereas benefits were general. In this period of capitalist modernity, happiness and justice were increasingly identified with the general interest of society rather than individual experiences. The tensions which the locational changes brought about in terms of value relations were also captured by the term sheref, which means honor. And it was regular streets as the material reflection of general interest that increasingly came to define sheref. My research therefore aims to position the term sheref in the conception of space as a social relation, therefore as something unfixed and relative. I take urban Tanzimat as competing processes of depreciation and appreciation where value took its social character as a struggle over sheref. The understanding of space as a social relation is especially important given the fact that private property entails a view of absolute space because it is exclusively owned. The line between absolute and social space is a conflictual area, just like the one between the general and private interest. The Ottoman term sheref implies relationality with regard to both space and value, which mediated the politics of location and the processes of special commodification in the city. So by taking streets as commodities and sheref as an expression of value, I seek the opposition between the individual and society as embedded in the contradictions between depreciation and appreciation, sacrifices and benefits, and general and private interest. My definition of property depends on the Marxist notion of property as a fictitious form of capital. But the term fictitious also needs to be put into a historical context. Therefore, another aim of mine is to historicize the concept fictitious and locate historical fictions that constitute it in practical terms. As I already suggested, I seek the fictitious character of property and the social nature of value in terms like sheref. Apart from sheref, apart from the term sheref, words like namus, haysiyet, itibar, and istikamet, and the meanings are given here, were some of the most common terms that both state institutions and property owners employed quite frequently within a political economy of planning. The way in which property owners associated honor with space and value not only reveals the rhetorical interplay between the notions of morality and justice, but also compels us to think the question of property value as a web of social relations imbued with moral values. Furthermore, words like yol, tariq, and cadde, literally meaning road or street, and the term istikamet meaning direction, also have moral and religious meanings in addition to their material senses. Such linguistic interfaces are telling in regard to the totalities of life, in which any separation between economics, morality, or politics for that matter, seems to be less real. After all, it is not a coincidence that the protection of property, honor, and life was the basis of all the reform edicts of the century and the Constitution of 1876. My research aims to illustrate the economic and ideological connotations of the unquestioned term honor in its intrinsic relation to property. It appears that honor was not only moral but an economic term revolved around the question of locational values within the context of fiction of urban rent. Therefore, my common objective is to present property in less immaterial terms and morality more in economic terms. So what was the role of women in the social construction of this fiction of urban rent? Well, first of all, judging from a scan reading of the cadastral survey of the city, my impressionistic view is that the percentage of ownership by women seems to be quite high. But this doesn't. This is not based on a statistical research, empirical research, because there is none at the moment. So it's just an impressionistic view. We also need to note that the most of the property in the city in the 19th century belonged to different religious endowments. Vakıf property was the dominant form of ownership, and long-term leasing systems, like the icaretayn system, icaretayn means double rent, were very widespread in the capital. Even though the issue of long-term leasing was a controversial issue, according to the Hanafit Vakf jurisprudence, the icaretayn system, this long-term leasing system, became a common practice from the 16th century onwards. The reason I mention this is that throughout its development, the icaretayn system also introduced a distinctive practice of inheritance. Usage rights on vakf properties that were rented through icaretayn system were inheritable by male and female offspring on an equal basis. This was different than Islamic law of succession that governed freehold properties, that is mulk property, which did not treat male and female children equally. This situation probably had an impact on the seemingly high percentage of ownership by women in the city. As seen in the cases that I discuss in my article for Havva, women as property owners were quite skillful, not only in defending their property rights, but also shaping social conventions of justice and morality. But I also need to clarify that by women, I largely refer to Muslim women here. Because I use petitions and non-Muslim women, I mean, the number of petitions presented by non-Muslim women is quite rare. Women like Habibe and Gülizar Hanım challenged city authorities that represented state institutions in varying capacities. Their challenge was a part of the local networks through which urban reforms were formulated and implemented. Their example, as well as the examples of male actors, show how local people negotiated value and morality in relation to justice and positioned their private interests vis-a-vis the general interest. In this period, property disputes resulting from urban reforms increasingly became an administrative matter. Instead of kadı courts, such conflicts were rather settled by the urban and municipal institutions. Petitioning was an important part of this new situation. It was a means for people to communicate their understanding of justice by positioning themselves against the contradictions of urban modernity. Petitions also had a role in creating a shared moral world between the government and people. The role of petitioning in defining moral obligations of the state is important in terms of the mutually constitutive relations between the state and its subjects. Therefore, by examining the petitions that property owners presented, we can give voice to the ideologies of honor and justice that local people invoked in relation to uneven and compelling processes of capitalist modernity in their daily environment. Their petitions are what renders capitalism non-linear, non-generic, and seemingly contradictory, and reprints modernity as an experience present. However, it wasn't only opposition that characterized the relations between the government and people. The process of urban restructuring also included compliance and, more importantly, corruption. But all in all, urban Tanzimat was a twofold process of appreciation and depreciation. Some people found their properties replaced in less valuable locations, whereas others came to have more valuable places. They were all actors who took a part in the definitions of general interests. The position of one actor was relational to that of others, within which the fiction of urban rent was socially constructed. Thank you.